there's a Canada long before there is a United States, but the Canada of the French Aboriginal fur trade is territorially very different than the Canada we now have. The United States, I think, is a response against the fact that the British Empire seemed to side with the mercantile economics of the fur trade by adding the interior of North America to the colony of Quebec, the French Roman Catholic colony of Quebec. This was a provocation to the Anglo-American colonists. And so where does the United States come from? What is the origins of the United States? Here I think we can find a lot about the origins of the United States that explain a lot about why the United States is acting the way the United States is acting these days. The United States was created because the British imperial government was not allowing for rapid enough Western expansion of the Europeans, was not allowing for efficient transformation of Indian country into private property. And the British imperial government seemed to be siding with Montreal and the mercantile trade interests of Montreal. So the effort was to create a new form of sovereignty, a form of sovereignty that would be better geared to rapid Western expansion, rapid privatization, a form of sovereignty that would be better geared to incorporate conquest as a means of empire building. Now, is the United States a nation? Is it a republic? Is it an empire? There's a lot of speculation about this, a lot of theorizing about this. Francis Jennings writes a book called The Creation of America Through Revolution to Empire. Francis Jennings. Now, just to go back to first principles here, when I say where is here, as we look out at the globe, where are we looking from? What's our orientation? And I said at the beginning, the way I'm starting to think about globalization, if you're really skilled at that kind of study, the methodology of globalization studies, if we say, you know, how did the world look from the Ottoman Empire in the late 1800s? You know, how did the world look from Africa, say from South Africa, in the early 20th century? How does the world look today from Tuktoyaktuk? How does the world look today from Sydney, Australia, or from Java in Indonesia? So as, you know, this is hard. This takes a lot of study of history, of geography, to be able to orient oneself and to be able to look out, imaginatively look out at the world from different vantage points. So I'm suggesting that let's start with our own vantage point. Well, that's problematic too. I mean, I think it's a fascinating thing about the way this course has unfolded that we have consistently had citizens of China, members of the class who are studying in Canada, but whose allegiance is to China, who are loyal to China, who have every intention of more kind of alternative to the West, or a vision of the planet rooted in an indigenous tradition, which represents the longest continuous development of a civilization on the planet. And yet, obviously, China and the United States, China and North America, are working closely hand in hand in a lot of ways, and there's a lot of merger there. So when I say, you know, how do we look at it from here, I've got to be cognizant that whenever you use the first person plural, that's problematic. Eh? We, us, ourselves, orienting ourselves to globalization. Who are us? Right? I can't assume anything really. Every individual will see it differently, will construct it differently. But in any case, I'm in emphasizing this history of Alberta, of Canada, of the United States, of Latin America, of the Western Hemisphere, and then beyond that, okay, as we start to conceive of a place that encompasses this planet, what is this place? Is it the world? Is it a globe? What's its address? What is that community? I'd like to think it's the Earth. I think the Earth is a powerful concept. You know, if somebody is earthy, they're kind of grounded. I guess when you talk about the different planets in space, this orb gets the name Earth. So, and how many people on the planet are really in a position to start thinking about that community of all human beings? And it's still, I think, a small part of the world, but it's happening. It's happening. If we were to really embrace the reality that we're all fellow human beings, then we couldn't think in terms of international wars and civil wars. They would all be civil wars, right? There is no other kind of war than a civil war. But, of course, the art of war is to invent, is to stimulate your people to imagine the other, to demonize some other, and to mobilize your population to sort of dehumanize that group or see that group as some different type of people, so very dramatic people, very dramatically different kind of people. So here is the Hudson's Bay Company territory. Okay, let me go on this for a bit. The fur trade, I found this a rather powerful picture. So, of course, liaison, love, friendship, marriage, creation, romance, the reality that the people coming in the process of colonization, European colonization, are mostly all men. Here's a McNeil has an interesting way of depicting this. So let's talk a little bit about gender relations and family. So here is a man leaving Europe, going off to the overseas colonies. So long, he's leaving the female, his mother, his wife, and off he goes. And here's a depiction of a kind of a It's a pretty erotic picture, I guess, or sensual picture, or with the baby. And look at that blasé man walking away from his child. But then here's another picture of a later stage, and he's coming willingly to a native woman, and actually embracing his child, and embracing the woman, and going off with her. So I've come to think about this as a major, major theme of European colonization. Who goes out and colonizes? Male missionaries, male soldiers, male traders. You know, it's a very gender. There's also no doubt homosexuals who go off and colonize, and so that's an element of it. When you think of the transfer of intellectual property, the knowledge that enables colonization to take place, so much of that knowledge comes from Aboriginal women who educate their husbands, their lovers, their friends, and there's whole mythologies built up around this. For instance, Pocahontas or Sacagawea, oftentimes the women's roles will be kind of made mythological and legendary. And I think there is in this a kind of mythological of colonization. In other words, Pocahontas in saving John Smith kind of sanctions the colonization of her land. Sacagawea helps Lewis and Clark and thereby seems to be sanctioning the whole process of U.S.'s Western expansion. So this is a depiction of that on the document camera here. Now here is one of these Aboriginal wives. So this is country wives, right, Lady Douglas of mixed ancestry. She became James Douglas's country wife at 16, his legal wife 13 years later. It was James Douglas who expanded British Columbia onto the mainland after the California Gold Rush, when it seemed that if Britain didn't move quickly, what is now British Columbia would just become an extension of California because the Californians were coming up for the Gold Rush. So this is his wife, and you see these very interesting pictures of some of these women were obviously treated well. There were big families, happy families. Sometimes the children were sent to Europe to school. Now, here's another similar picture of a fur trade family. Richard Hardesty, Belle Lougheed's uncle. So this family here becomes part of the Lougheeds, and I thought this might bring it home to Alberta because, of course, Peter Lougheed, who everybody knows in Alberta, comes from one of these fur trade families. So Peter Lougheed is actually Métis or Métis. Peter Lougheed has an Indian strain in his family tree. So this is a book about a couple of buildings in Calgary written by my friend Don Smith. And Don Smith teaches at the University of Calgary. We both did our PhDs in Canadian history with J.M.S. Careless at the University of Toronto. And so he says to Tony with best wishes, from a microhistorian to a macro, I hope that you enjoy Calgary's grand story. So we kind of joke about how you can diverge. Don gets a huge amount of information about, say, a building, the Lougheed building in Calgary. And he jokes about me doing macro, you know, kind of going to the big and he's going to the small. Anyway, you can find meaning in all kinds of ways. So he looks at, how many of you have been to the Lougheed House? It's in Calgary. It's been rebuilt, renovated. The famous Senator James Lougheed, politician, lawyer, and capitalist. Lougheed married Belle Lougheed, and so here is Belle Lougheed's father, and you can see he's a fur trade man. You can see that you can pretty well see he has Aboriginal ancestry. William Hardesty, Bell's father, Hudson's Bay Company chief factor of the Mackenzie River Valley, photo taken around 1880 by Inglis, Montreal Glenville Archives. Here's Bell Lougheed. You can see she's a prosperous person, an elite of Calgary. And the pattern of the transformation of Hudson's Bay Company and the wealth of the created by the Hudson's Bay Company into the Canadian Pacific Railway Company. In fact, the very lobby that is seeking to develop Canada as a way to create a platform for the Canadian Pacific Railway, they take over the shares of the Hudson's Bay Company. And obviously the transformation of Canada from a fur trade domain to a domain dominated by the Canadian Pacific Railway Company, it changes the nature of land tenure, it changes the whole nature of the economy. Here's a very dramatic picture of Alberta in transformation. So there is Fort Edmonton, which I hadn't realized till I saw this picture, that it was actually on the front yard of the legislature. And there's the legislature being built in 1912. So let's go a little into prior to 1905, when this area here, of course, is a familiar picture of Chief Mountain. It's interesting as you look out at Chief Mountain to realize it's in Montana, and it's clearly I can see it from my window. House, Chief Mountain. Nitsipasini, the story of Blackfoot people. The Blackfoot in their own language call themselves Nitsitapi. So I'm going to observe some aspects of the history of this part of the world. Now here's a picture of the fur trade post, Rocky Mountain House, which of course is connects over the mountain. So you can see there's Fort Edmonton, Nelson House. You can see that the main route is very much along the northern Saskatchewan, and of course from this area you can head north into the Athabasca. Athabasca refers to the language of the Indians. The Athabascan speakers, in a group of them in 1975, started calling themselves Dene, which is their name for people. They started to affirm their identity as the Dene Nation in the Northwest Territories. Dene is Athabascan for people. Another big Athabascan-speaking group are the Navajo in southwestern United States. So if we look at this rendition of this area as it was with respect to the fur trade, we can clearly see that it's the North Saskatchewan, the South Saskatchewan, the Porcupine Hills is not an area where there is a lot of presence of the Northwest Company or later the Hudson's Bay Company, which takes over the Northwest Company. But then look what happens subsequently. These are the whiskey trading posts. And so Fort Whoopup was the most notorious of all the whiskey trading posts. So the item that was sought after was buffalo hides. Buffalo hides were very good in making conveyor belts for industrial processes because I guess they're so big, buffalo are big, that you can get a long strip of hide and you don't have to sew it because whenever you sew hides together, it's problematic if you're trying to create a belt for some kind of production process. I find that a very powerful image. Isn't it a powerful image to think of the buffalo being transformed into assembly line processes to industrialize North America? So that's what's taking place. The whiskey trade. So this is a Blackfoot publication, a Nitsitapi publication. And so it's written as Blackfoot people telling their own story. So this is what this publication has to say. Whiskey was the most important commodity these Americans traded. The effects were disastrous. Brothers killed brothers in drunken brawls. Men began to beat their wives. Some men sold their wives to traders in exchange for whiskey and food. And the buffalo herds became smaller. This is infamous. Fort Whoopup, if you go to, say, a gas station where they're set up so you can't rob the gas station, there's an invisible shield, some kind of plastic shield. You put the money in a tray. You pull the tray in. You get the change. You get it back. There was a similar thing at Fort Whoopup where you put the furs in a container. The container is pulled inside the fort. Then some whiskey is poured out. But apparently this whiskey was also mixed with toxic substances, urine. It was really toxic stuff. I guess the scene outside Fort Whoopup was just horrific. Here is, if we can go back to the docu-camera, for buffalo robes, the Americans traded primarily whiskey. The rot gut mixture of alcohol, pepper, gunpowder, and other toxin poisoned the Blackfoot. Bull Plume's winter count symbol recounts the death toll from the whiskey trade. So winter count is a way of recording history, what happened every winter. And look at this. It's Blackfeet. 29 died from whiskey. 92 blood Indians died from whiskey. 30 pagan Indians died from whiskey. So this is a very... how many people really understand that Fort Whoopup is a U.S. post? It's a U.S. post. Has Lethbridge really matured beyond Fort Whoopup, a whiskey trading post to the Blackfoot Indians? I mean, I think that's a question that one could ask. I mean, do you see a lot of Blackfoot Indians working in Lethbridge, you know, working in the stores? What is the commerce of Lethbridge then? What is it now? How much has it changed? I think that's a fair question. This was, this is part of the legend of Canada, part of the propaganda of Canada. And there's some basis of truth in it, that the Northwest Mounted Police was created to regulate this situation. That obviously what we now call Alberta was becoming part of Montana, was being incorporated into the economic system of Montana. And there was a power vacuum. If we can go to the, these whiskey trading posts. It's not only Fort Whoopup. You know, there's Fort Kipp. There's many around here. Healy was one of the whiskey traders. Healy is a name on the blood reserve to this day, and I assume that's the origin of that name. So, the story of the whiskey trading post. Of course, they're going into a power vacuum. Hudson's Bay Company sells their titles to the Dominion of Canada in 1869-70. and yet the Canadian Pacific Railway isn't finished until 1885. So although the Hudson's Bay Company withdraws its claim after 1869-70, and of course Louis Riel is there to say, you better deal with the indigenous people. We're not just trees. We're not just deer. You know, we have our own way of life, and we have forms of title and legal relationships among ourselves, and you have to deal with that. So there was a period there where indigenous people had some bargaining power and forced Canada into the negotiation of the numbered treaties. It was this period after the withdrawal of the Hudson's Bay Company's titles and before the coming of the CPR where how would the land be held for the Dominion of Canada? So the Northwest Mounted Police were created. They came and regulated the whiskey trade. As the text here says, at first our people thought the Redcoats were helping us. They chased the whiskey traders back to the United States. Canada at least became a sanctuary from liquor. But soon the Redcoats began enforcing their own laws. Hunting was restricted. Our people could no longer defend their territories against other First Nations. Of course, Colonel McLeod befriended Crowfoot. It was on the basis of that friendship that Treaty 7 was largely created. Interestingly, although the Northwest Mounted Police made a show of ejecting the whiskey traders, they continued to be supplied themselves by the I.F. Baker Company, which was an extension of the American Fur Trade Company. John Jacob Astor, of course, the famous U.S. Real estate developer, the origins of his wealth were in the fur trade. So the RCMP even continued to get supplied from the Missouri River system. The Whoop-Up Trail, you know, continues to this day. This, in a way, is the most Americanized part of Canada, the part of Canada where there's probably the least sympathy to the government of in Ottawa and the most sympathy to the government in Washington. Now, of course, the fact that this area has now created the government in Ottawa creates a historic moment where we'll see. You know, you can't, it's harder just to demonize the national government now. It's going to have interesting implications for the identity of Alberta. So,